from the psych ward at Bellevue and drove them straight to Trader Vic's. Everything was fabulous, even our breakdowns. There had been a tick in my left eye. I tried to ignore it, but it felt like one of Blaine's clock hands moving time around my face. I had been lovely once. Lara Liveman, Midwestern girl, blonde child of privilege, my father the owner of an automobile empire, my mother a Norwegian model. I am not afraid to say it. I'd had enough beauty to get taxi drivers fighting. But I could feel the late nights draining me. My teeth were turning a tinge darker from too much Benzedrine. My eyes were dull. Sometimes it seemed that they were even taking my hair color. An odd sensation, the life disappearing through the follicles, a sort of tingling. Instead of working on my own art, I went to the hairdresser twice, three times a week, $25 a time. I tipped her another 15 and walked down the avenue crying. I would get back to painting again. I was sure of it. All I needed was another day, another hour. The less work we did, the more valuable we thought we had become. I had been working toward abstract urban landscapes. A few collectors had been hovering at the edges. I just needed to find the stamina to finish. But instead of my studio, I stepped from the sunlight in Union Square into the comfortable dark of Max's. All the bouncers knew me. A cocktail was placed on the table, a Manhattan first, washed down with a white Russian. I was airborne within minutes. I wandered around, chatted, flirted, laughed. Rock stars in the back room and artists in the front. Men in the women's bathroom, women in the men's, smoking, talking, kissing, fucking. Trays of hash brownies carried around, men snorting lines of coke through the carcasses of pens. Time was in jeopardy when I was at Max's. People wore their watches with the faces turned against their skin. By the time dinner rolled around, it could have been the next day. Sometimes it was 3 days later when I finally got out. The light hit my eyes when I opened the door onto Park Avenue South and 17th Street. Occasionally, Blaine was with me. More often, he wasn't. And there were times, quite honestly, I wasn't sure. The parties rolled on like rain. Down in the village, the door of our dealer, Billy Lee, was always open. He was a tall, thin, handsome man. He had a set of dice that we used for sex games. There was a joke around that people came and went in Billy's place, but mostly they came. His apartment was littered with stolen prescription pads, each script in triplicate with an individual BNDD number. He had stolen them from doctor's offices on the Upper East Side. He used to go along the ground floor offices on Park and Madison, kick the air conditioners in, and then crawl through the open window. We knew a doctor on the Lower East Side who would write the prescriptions. Billy was popping 20 pills a day. He said sometimes his heart felt as if it wrapped itself around his tongue. He had a thing for the waitresses at Max's. The only one who eluded him was a blonde named Debbie. Sometimes I substituted for whichever waitress didn't make it. Billy recited passages from Finnegan's Wake in my ear, the father of fornicationists. He had learned 20 pages by heart. It sounded like a sort of jazz. Later, I could hear his voice ringing in my ear. In Blaine's and my apartment, there were a few citations for loud music, once an arrest for possession, but it was a police raid that finally stalled us. A crashing through the door. The cops swarming around the place. "Get to your feet!" One of them bashed my ankle with a nightstick. I was too scared to scream. It was no ordinary raid. Billy was lifted from our couch, kicked to the floor, strip-searched in front of us. He was taken away in cuffs, part of a Federal Bureau of Narcotics sting. We got away with a warning. They were watching us, they said. Blaine and I crawled around the city looking for a bump. Nobody we knew was selling. Max's was closed for the night. The tough-eyed queers on Little West 12th wouldn't let us into their clubs. There was a haze over Manhattan. We bought a bag on Houston, but it turned out to be baking soda. We still stuffed it up our noses in case there was a small remnant of Coke. We walked to the Bowery among the Plainsong drunks and got smashed against a grocery store grate and robbed at knife point by 3 Filipino kids in leather jackets. We ended up in the doorway of an East Side pharmacy.
"Look what we've done to ourselves,"
said Blaine, blood all over his shirt front. I couldn't stop my eye from pulsing. I lay there, the wet of the ground seeping into my bones, not even enough desire to weep. An early morning greaseball threw a quarter at our feet. E pluribus unum. It was one of those moments from which I knew there would be no return. There comes a point when, tired of losing, you decide to stop failing yourself, or at least to try, or to send up the final flare, one last chance. We sold the loft we owned in Soho and bought the log cabin so far upstate that it would be a long walk back to Max's ever again. What Blaine had wanted was a year or two, maybe more, in the sticks. No distraction. To return to the moment of radical innocence. To paint, to stretch canvas, to find the point of originality. It wasn't a hippie idea. Both of us had always hated the hippies, their flowers, their poems, their one idea. We were the furthest thing from the hippies. We were the edge, the definers. We developed our idea to live in the 20s, a Scott and Zelda going clean. We kept our antique car, even got it refurbished, the seats reupholstered, the dashboard buffed. I cut my hair flapper style. We loaded up on provisions, eggs, flour, milk, sugar, salt, honey, oregano, chili, and racks of cured meat that we hung from a nail in the ceiling. We wiped away the cobwebs and filled the cupboards with rice, grain, jams, marshmallows. We believed we'd eventually be that clean. Blaine had decided it was time to go back to canvas, to paint in the style of Thomas Benton or John Stuart Curry. He wanted that moment of purity, regionalism. He was sick of the colleagues he'd gone to Cornell with, the Smithsons and the Turleys and the Mata Clarks. They had done as much as they possibly could, he said. There was no going further for them. Their spiral jetties and split houses and pilfered garbage cans were passé. Me too. I'd decided that I wanted the pulse of the trees in my work, the journey of grass, some dirt. I thought I might be able to capture water in some new and startling way. We had painted the new landscape separately. The pond, the kingfisher, the silence, the moon perched on the saddle of the trees, the slashes of red wings among the leaves. We had kicked the drugs. We had made love. It all went so well. So very, very well. Until our trip back to Manhattan. A blue dawn stretched in the room. Blaine lay like a stranded thing. All the way across the bed, impossible to wake, grinding his teeth in his sleep, a thinness to him, his cheekbones too pronounced, but he was not unhandsome. There were times he still reminded me of a polo player. I left him in bed and went out onto the porch. It was just before sunrise, and already the heat had burned the night rain off the grass. A light wind riffled across the surface of the lake. I could hear the faintest sounds of traffic from the highway a few miles away, a low gurgle. A single jet stream cut across the sky, like a line of disappearing coke. My head was pounding, my throat dry. It took a moment to realize that the previous 2 days had actually occurred. Our trip to Manhattan, the humiliation at Max's, the car crash, a night of sex. What had been a quiet life had gotten its noise again. I looked over at the hut where Blaine had hidden the Pontiac. We had forgotten the paintings, left them out in the rain. We hadn't even covered them in plastic. They sat, ruined, leaning against the side of the hut by some old wagon wheels. I bent down and flicked through. A whole year's work. The water and paint had bled down into the grass. The frames would soon warp. Fabulous irony. All the wasted work, the cutting of canvas, the pulling of hair from brushes, the months and months spent painting. You clip a van, you watch your life fade away. I let Blaine be, didn't tell him, spent the whole day avoiding him. I walked in the woods, around the lake, out onto the dirt roads. Gather all around the things that you love, I thought, and prepare to lose them. I sat pulling the roots of vines off trees. It felt like the only valuable thing I could do. That night, I went to bed while Blaine stared out over the water, licking the very last of the coke from the inside of the plastic baggie. The following morning, with the paintings still out by the garage, I walked toward town. At a certain stage, every single thing can be a sign. Halfway down the road, a group of starlings flew up from a pile of discarded car batteries. The Trophy Diner was at the end of Main Street, in the shadow of the Bell Tower Church. A row of pickup trucks stood outside with empty gun racks in their windows. A few station wagons were parked on the church grounds. Weeds had cracked through the pavement at the door. The bell clanged. The locals on the swivel seats turned to check me out. More of them than usual. Baseball caps and cigarettes. They turned quickly away again, huddled and chatting. It didn't bother me. They never had much time for me anyway. I smiled across at the waitress, but she didn't gesture back. I took one of the red booths under a painting of ducks in flight. Some sugar packets, straws, and napkins were scattered on the table. I wiped the formica top clean, made a structure out of toothpicks. The men along the stools were loud and charged up, but I couldn't make out what they were saying. There was a momentary panic that they somehow knew of the accident, but it seemed beyond the bounds of logic. Calm down. Sit. Eat breakfast. Watch the world slide by. The waitress finally came and slid the menu across the table, placed a coffee in front of me without even asking. She usually wore her weariness like an autograph, but there was something jumped up about her as she hurried back to the counter and settled in once more among the men. There were small drip marks on the white coffee mug where it hadn't been washed properly. I scrubbed it with a paper napkin. On the floor beneath me, there was a newspaper, folded over and egg-stained, the New York Times. I hadn't read a paper in almost a year. In the cabin, we had a radio with a crank arm that we had to wind up if we wanted to listen to the outside world. I kicked the paper under the far side of the booth. The prospect of news was nothing in the face of the accident and the paintings we had lost as a result. A full year's work gone. I wondered what might happen when Blaine found out. I could see him rising from bed, tousled, shirtless, scratching himself, the male crotch adjust, walking outside and looking over at the hut, shaking himself awake, running through the long grass, which would rebound behind him. He didn't have much of a temper, one of the things I still loved about him, but I could foresee the cabin strewn with bits and pieces of the smashed frames. You want to arrest the clocks? Stop everything for half a second. Give yourself a chance to do it over again. Rewind the life. Uncrash the car. Run it backward. Have her lift miraculously back into the windshield. Unshatter the glass. Go about your day untouched. Some old, lost, sweet-tasting time. But there it was again. The girl's spreading bloodstain. I tried to catch the waitress's eye. She was leaning on her elbows on the counter, chatting with the men. Something about their urgency trilled through the room. I coughed loudly and smiled across at her again. She sighed as if to say that she'd be there for God's sake. Don't push me. She rounded the counter, but stopped once more in the middle of the floor, laughed at some intimate joke. One of the men had unfolded his paper. Nixon's face on the front page rolled briefly before me, all slicked back and rehearsed and gluttonous. I had always hated Nixon, not just for obvious reasons, but it seemed to me that he had learned not only to destroy what was left behind, but also to poison what was to come. My father had part-owned a car company in Detroit, and the whole enormity of our family wealth had disappeared in the past few years. It wasn't that I wanted the inheritance. I didn't, not at all. But I could see my youth receding in front of me. Those good moments when my father had carried me on his shoulders and tickled my underarms and even tucked me in bed, kissed my cheek. Those days gone now, made increasingly distant by change. What's going on? My voice as casual as possible, the waitress with her pen poised over her writing pad.
You didn't hear? Nixon's gone.
Shot?
Hell no, resigned.
Today?
No, tomorrow, honey. Next week, Christmas.
Excuse me?
She tapped her pen against the sharp of her chin.
What do you want?
I stammered an order for a Western omelet and sipped from the water in the hard plastic glass. A quick shot image across my mind. Before I met Blaine, before the drugs and the art and the village, I had been in love with a boy from Dearborn. He'd volunteered for Vietnam, came home with a 1,000-yard stare and a piece of bullet lodged perfectly in his spine. In his wheelchair, he stunned me by campaigning for Nixon in 68, going around the inner city, still giving his approval to all he couldn't understand. We had broken up over the campaign. I thought I knew what Vietnam was. We would leave it all rubble and blood soak. The repeated lies become history, but they don't necessarily become the truth. He had swallowed them all, even plastered his wheelchair with stickers, "Nixon loves Jesus." He went door to door, spreading rumors about Hubert Humphrey. He even bought me a little chain with a Republican elephant. I had worn it to please him, to give him back his legs. But it was like the firelight had faded on the inside of his eyelids and his mind was punched away in a little drawer. I still wondered what might have happened if I had stayed with him and learned to praise ignorance. He had written to me that he had seen Blaine's Clock Tower film and it had made him laugh so hard he had fallen out of his chair. He couldn't get up. Now he was crawling. Was it possible to help him up? At the end of the letter, he said, "Fuck you, you heartless bitch. You rolled up my heart and squeezed it dry." Still, when I recalled him, I would always see him waiting for me under the silver high school bleachers with a smile on his face and 32 perfect shining white teeth. The mind makes its shotgun leaps. Punch them away, yes, in a drawer. I saw the girl from the crash again. Her face appearing over his shoulder. It was not the whites of her feet this time. She was full and pretty. No eyeshadow, no makeup, no pretense. She was smiling at me and asking me why I had driven away. Did I not want to talk to her? Why didn't I stop? Come, come, please. Did I not want to see the piece of metal that had ripped open her spine? And how about the pavement she had caressed at 50 miles per hour?
"You all right?" asked the waitress, sliding the plate of food across the table.
"Fine, yeah."
She peered into the full cup and said, "Something wrong?"
"Just not in the mood."
She looked at me like I was quite possibly alien. "No coffee? Call the House of Un-American Activities."
"Hell with you," I thought. "Leave me be. Go back to your unwashed cups."
I sat silently and smiled at her. The omelet was wet and runny. I took a single bite and could feel the grease unsettling my stomach. I bent down and extended my foot under the table, pulled in yesterday's newspaper, lifted it up. It was open to an article about a man who had walked on a tightrope between the World Trade Center towers. He had, it seemed, scoped out the building for 6 years and had finally not just walked, but danced across, even lay down on the cable. He said that if he saw oranges, he wanted to juggle them. If he saw skyscrapers, he wanted to walk between them. I wondered what he might do if he walked into the diner and found the scattered pieces of me lying around, too many of them to juggle. I flicked through the rest of the pages. Some cypress, some water treatment, a murder in Brooklyn, but mostly Nixon and Ford and Watergate. I didn't know much about the scandal. It was not something Blaine and I had followed, establishment politics at its coldest, another sort of napalm descending at home. I was happy to see Nixon resign, but it would hardly usher in a revolution. Nothing much more would happen than Ford might have 100 days, and then he too would put in an order for more bombs. It seemed to me that nothing much good had happened since the day Sirhan Sirhan had pulled the malevolent trigger. The idol was over. Freedom was a word that everyone mentioned, but none of us knew. There wasn't much left for anyone to die for, except the right to remain peculiar. In the paper, there was no mention of a crash on the FDR Drive, not even a little paragraph buried below the fold. But there she was, still looking at me. It wasn't the driver who struck me at all, I don't know why. It was still her, only her. I was wading up through the shadows toward her, and the car engine was still whining, and she was haloed in bits of broken glass. How great are you, God? Save her. Pick her up off the pavement and dust the glass from her hair. Wash the fake blood off the ground. Save her here and now. Put her mangled body back together again. I had a headache, my mind reeling. I could almost feel myself swaying in the booth. Maybe it was the drugs flushing out of my body. I picked up a piece of toast and just held it at my lips, but even the smell of butter nauseated me. Out the window, I saw an antique car with white wall tires pull up against the curb. It took me a moment to realize it wasn't a hallucination, something cinematic hauled from memory. The door opened and a shoe hit the ground. Blaine climbed out and shielded his eyes. It was almost the exact same gesture as on the highway 2 days before. He was wearing a lumber shirt and jeans, no old-fashioned clothes. He looked like he belonged upstate. He flicked the hair back from his eyes. As he crossed the road, the small-town traffic paused for him. Hands deep in his pockets, he strolled along the windows of the diner and threw me a smile. There was a puzzling jaunt in his step, walking with his upper body cocked back a notch. He looked like an ad man, all patently false. I could see him suddenly in a seersucker suit. He smiled again. Perhaps he had heard about Nixon. More likely he hadn't yet seen the paintings, ruined beyond repair. The bell sounded on the door, and I saw him wave across to the waitress and nod to the men. He had a palette knife sticking out of his shirt pocket.
You look pale, honey.
Nixon resigned, I said. He smiled broadly as he leaned over the table and kissed me.
Big swinging dicky. Guess what? I found the paintings.
I shuddered.
They're far out, he said.
What?
They got left out in the rain the other night.
I saw that.
Utterly changed.
I'm sorry.
You're sorry?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Blaine. I'm sorry.
Whoa, whoa!
Whoa what, Blaine?
Don't you see? He said. You give it a different ending. It becomes new. You can't see that?
I turned my face up to his, looked him square in the eye, and said, No, I didn't see. I couldn't see anything. Not a goddamn thing. That girl was killed, I said.
Oh, Christ, not that again.
Again? It was the day before yesterday, Blaine.
How many times am I going to have to tell you? Not our fault. Lighten up.
And keep your fucking voice down, Lara, in here for crying out loud.
He reached across and took my hand, his eyes narrow and intent.
Not our fault. Not our fault. Not our fault.
It wasn't as if he'd been speeding, he said, or had had an intention to go rear-end some asshole who couldn't drive. Things happen. Things collide.
He speared a piece of my omelet. He held the fork out and half pointed it at me. He lowered his eyes, ate the food, chewed it slowly.
I've just discovered something and you're not listening.
It was like he wanted to prod me with a dumb joke.
A moment of Satori, he said.
Is it about her?
You have to stop, Lara. You have to pull yourself together. Listen to me.
About Nixon?
No, it's not about Nixon. Fuck Nixon. History will take care of Nixon. Listen to me, please. You're acting crazy.
There was a dead girl.
Enough already. Lighten the fuck up.
He might be dead too, the guy.
Shut the fuck. It was just a tap. That's all. Nothing else. His brake lights weren't working.
Just then, the waitress came over, and Blaine released my hand. He ordered himself a trophy special with eggs, extra bacon, and venison sausage. The waitress backed away, and he smiled at her, watched her go, the sway of her.
Look, he said, it's about time. When you think about it, they're about time.
What's about time?
The paintings. They're a comment on time.
Oh, Jesus, Blaine.
There was a shine in his eyes, unlike any I'd seen in quite a while. He sliced open some packets of sugar, dumped them in his coffee. Some extra grains spilled out on the table.
Listen, we made our 20s paintings, right? And we lived in that time, right? There's a mastery there. I mean, they were steady-keeled, the paintings. You said so yourself. And they referred back to that time, right? They maintained their formal manners, a stylistic armor about them, right? Even a monotony. They happened on purpose. We cultivated them. But did you see what the weather did to them?
I saw, yeah.
Well, I went out there this morning and the damn things floored me. But then I started looking through them and they were beautiful and ruined. Don't you see?
No.
What happens if we make a series of paintings and we leave them out in the weather? We allow the present to work on the past. We could do something radical here. Do the formal paintings in the style of the past and have the present destroy them. You let the weather become the imaginative force. The real world works on your art. So you give it a new ending. And then you reinterpret it. It's perfect, Dick.
The girl died, Blaine.
Give it over.
No.
I won't give it over.
He threw up his hands and then slammed them down on the table. The solitary sugar grains jumped. Some men at the counter turned and flicked a look at us.
Oh, fuck, he said. There's no use talking to you.
His breakfast came and he ate it sullenly. He kept looking up at me like I might suddenly change, become the beauty he had once married. But his eyes were blue and hateful. He ate the sausage with a sort of savagery, stabbed at it as if it angered him, this thing once alive. A little bit of egg stuck at the side of his mouth where he hadn't shaved properly. He tried to talk of his new project, that a man could find meaning anywhere. His voice buzzed like a trapped fly. His desire for surety, for meaning. He needed me as part of his patterns.
I felt the urge to tell Blaine that I had in fact spent my whole life really loving the Nixon boy in the wheelchair, and that it had all been pabulum since then, and juvenile, and useless, and tiresome. All of our art, all our projects, all our failures, it was just pure cast-off, and none of it mattered. But instead I just sat there, saying nothing, listening to the faint hum of voices from the counter and the rattle of the forks against the plates.
"We're finished here,"
he said. Blaine snapped his fingers and the waitress came running. He left an extravagant tip and we stepped outside into the sunlight. Blaine tipped a pair of giant sunglasses over his eyes, extended his stride, and walked toward the garage at the end of Main Street. I followed a couple of paces behind. He didn't turn, didn't wait.
"Hey, man, can you get a special order?"
he said to a pair of legs that were extended from underneath the car. The mechanic wheeled himself out, stared upward, blinked.
"What can I get you, bud?"
"A replacement headlight for my 1927 Pontiac and a front fender."
"A what?
Can you get them or not?"
"This is America, Chief."
"Get them, then."
"It takes time, man, and money."
"No problem," said Blaine. "I got both."
The mechanic picked at his teeth, then grinned. He labored over toward a cluttered desk, files and pencil shavings and pinup calendar girls. Blaine's hands were shaking, but he didn't care. He was caught up on himself now and what he would do with his paintings once the car was fixed. As soon as the light and the fender could get repaired, the whole matter would be forgotten, and then he'd work. I had no idea how long this new obsession might last for him. An hour, another year, a lifetime.
"You coming?"
said Blaine as we stepped out of the garage.
"I'd rather walk."
"We should film this," he said. "You know, how this new series gets painted and all? All from the very beginning. Make a document of it, don't you think?"
A row of smokers stood out in front of Metropolitan Hospital on 98th and 1st Avenue. Each looked like his last cigarette, ashen and ready to fall. Through the swinging doors, the receiving room was full to capacity. Another cloud of smoke inside, patches of blood on the floor. Junkies strung out along the benches. It was the type of hospital that looked like it needed a hospital. I walked through the gauntlet. It was the fifth receiving room I had visited, and I had begun to think that perhaps both the driver and the young woman had been killed on impact and were taken immediately to a morgue. A security guard pointed me toward an information booth. A window was cut into the wall of an unmarked room at the end of the corridor. A stout woman sat framed by it. From a distance, it looked as if she sat in a television set. Her eyeglasses dangled at her neck. I sidled up to the window and whispered about a man and woman who might have been brought in from a crash on Wednesday afternoon.
"Oh, you're a relative,"
she said, not even glancing up at me.
"Yes," I stammered, "a cousin."
"You're here for his things?"
"His what?"
She gave me a quick once-over.
"His things."
"Yes."
"You'll have to sign for them."
Within 15 minutes, I found myself standing with a box of the late John A. Corrigan's possessions. They consisted of a pair of black trousers that had been slit up the side with hospital scissors, a black shirt, a stained white undershirt, underwear and socks in a plastic bag, a religious medal, a pair of dark sneakers with the soles worn through, his driver's license, a ticket for parking illegally on John Street at 7:44 a.m. on Wednesday, August 7th, a packet of rolling tobacco, some papers, a few dollars, and, oddly, a keychain with a picture of two young black children on it. There was also a baby pink lighter, which seemed at odds with all the other things. I didn't want the box. I had taken it out of embarrassment, out of a sense of duty to my lie,
an obligation to save face, and perhaps even to save my hide. I had begun to think that perhaps leaving the scene of the crime was manslaughter, or at least some sort of felony, and now there was a second crime, hardly momentous, but it sickened me. I wanted to leave the box on the steps of the hospital and run away from myself. I had set all these events in motion, and all they got from me was a handful of a dead man's things. I was clearly out of my depth. Now it was time to go home, but I had taken on this man's blood-stained baggage. I stared at the license. He looked younger than my freeze-frame memory had made him, a pair of oddly frightened eyes looking way beyond the camera.
And the girl?
She was DOA,
said the woman like it was a traffic signal. She looked up at me and adjusted her glasses on her nose.
Anything else?
No, thanks, I stammered.
The only things I could really jigsaw together was that John A. Corrigan, born January 15, 1943, 5'10", 156 pounds, blue eyes, was probably the father of two young black children in the Bronx. Perhaps he had been married to the girl who was thrown through the windshield. Maybe the girls in the keychain were his daughters, grown now. Or perhaps it was something clandestine, as Blaine had said. He could have been having an affair with the dead woman. A photocopy of some medical information was folded at the bottom of the box, his sign-out chart. The scrawl was almost indecipherable. Cardiac tamponade, clindamycin, 300 milligrams. I was for a moment out on the highway again. The fender touched the back of his van, and I was spinning now in his big brown van. Walls, water, guardrails. The scent of his shirt rose up as I walked out into the fresh air. I had the odd desire to distribute his tobacco to the smokers hanging around outside. A crowd of Puerto Rican kids were hanging around in front of the Pontiac. They wore colored sneakers and wide flares and had cigarette packets shoved under their t-shirt sleeves. They could smell my nerves as I sidled through. A tall, thin boy reached over my shoulder and pulled out the plastic bag of Corrigan's underwear, gave a fake shriek, dropped them to the ground. The others laughed, a pack laugh. I bent down to pick up the bag, but felt a brush of a hand against my breast. I drew myself as tall as I possibly could and stared in the boy's eyes.
Don't you dare.
I felt so much older than my 28 years, as if I'd taken on decades in the last few days. He backed off two paces.
Only looking?
Well, don't.
Give me a ride.
Pontiac,
shouted one boy.
Poor old nigger thinks it's a Cadillac.
Give me one, lady.
More giggles. Over his shoulder, I could see a hospital security guard making his way toward us. He wore a kufi and loped as he came across, talking into a radio. The kids scattered and ran down the street, whooping.
You all right, ma'am? Said the security guard.
I was fumbling with the keys at the door of the car. I kept thinking the guard was going to walk around the front and see the smashed headlight and put two and two together, but he just guided me out into the traffic. In the rearview mirror, I saw him picking up the plastic bag of underwear I'd left on the pavement. He held them in the air a moment and then shrugged, threw them in the garbage can at the side of the road. I turned the corner towards 2nd Avenue, weeping. I had gone to the city ostensibly to buy a newfangled video camera for Blaine to record the journey of his new paintings. But the only stores I knew were way down on 14th Street near my old neighborhood. Who was it said that you can't go home anymore? I found myself driving to the west side of the city instead, out to a little parking area in Riverside Park, along by the water. The cardboard box sat in the passenger seat beside me. An unknown man's life. I had never done anything like this before. My intent had entered the world and become combustible. It had been given to me far too easily, Just a simple signature and a thank you. I thought about dropping it all in the Hudson, but there are certain things we just cannot bring ourselves to do. I stared at his photograph again. It was not he who had led me here, but the girl. I still knew nothing about her. It made no sense. What was I going to do? Practice a new form of resurrection? I got out of the car and fished in a nearby garbage can for a newspaper and scanned through it to see if I could find any death notices or an obituary. There was one, an editorial, for Nixon's America, but none for a young black girl caught in a hit and run. I screwed up my courage and drove to the Bronx toward the address on the license. Entire blocks of abandoned lots, cyclone fences topped with shredded plastic bags, stunted catalpa trees bent by the wind, auto body shops, new and used, the smell of burning rubber and brick. On a half wall, someone had written, "Dante has already disappeared." It took ages to find the place. There were a couple of police cars out under the Major Deegan. Two of the cops had a box of donuts sitting on the dashboard between them, like a third-rate TV show. They stared at me, open-mouthed, when I pulled up the car alongside them. I had lost all sense of fear. If they wanted to arrest me for a hit-and-run, then go ahead.
"This is a rough neighborhood, ma'am," one of them said in a New York nasal. "Car like that's gonna raise a few eyebrows."
"What can we do for you, ma'am?" said the other.
"Maybe not call me ma'am?"
"Feisty, huh? What you want, lady? Nothing but trouble here."
As if to confirm, a huge refrigerator truck slowed down as it came through the traffic lights, and the driver rolled down the window and eased over to the curb, looked out, then suddenly gunned it when he saw the police car.
"No nig-knock today,"
shouted the cop to the passing truck. The short one blanched a little when he looked back at me, and he gave a thin smile that creased his eyelids. He ran his hands over a tube of fat that bulged out at his waist.
"No trade today," he said, almost apologetically.
"So what can we do for you, miss?" said the other.
"I'm looking to return something."
"Oh, yeah?
I have these things here, in my car."
"Where'd you get that? What is it, like the 1850s?
"It's my husband's." Two thin smiles, but they looked happy enough that I'd broken their tedium. They stepped over to my car and rumbled around, running their hands along the wooden dash, marveling at the handbrake. I had often wondered if Blaine and I had gone on our 20s kick simply so we could keep our car. We had bought it as a wedding present for ourselves. Every time I sat in it, it felt like a return to simpler times. The second cop peered into the box of possessions. They were disgusting, but I was hardly in a position to say anything. I felt a sudden pang of guilt for the plastic bag of underwear that I had left behind at the hospital, as if it somehow might be needed now to complete the person who was not around. The cop picked up the parking ticket and then the license from the bottom of the box. The younger one nodded.
"Hey, that's the Irish guy, the priest."
"Sure is."
"The one that was giving us shit about the hookers. He drove that funky van."
"He's up there on the fifth floor. I mean, his brother, cleaning out his stuff."
"A priest?" I said.
"A monk or some such. One of these worker guys. Liberation Theo whateveritis."
"Theologian," said the other.
"One of those guys who thinks that Jesus was on welfare."
I felt a shudder of hatred, then told the cops that I was a hospital administrator and that the items needed to be returned. Did they mind leaving them with the dead man's brother?
"Not our job, miss."
"See the path there, around the side? Follow that to the fourth brown building. In to the left. Take the elevator."
"Or the stairs.
Be careful, but..."
I wondered how many assholes it took to make a police department. They had been made braver and louder by the war. They had a swagger to them. 10,000 men at the water cannons,
shoot the niggers, club the radicals, love it or leave it, believe nothing unless you hear it from us. I walked toward the projects, a surge of dread, hard to calm the heart when it leaps so high. As a child, I saw horses trying to step into rivers to cool themselves off. You watch them move from the stand of buckeye trees, down the slope, through the mud, swishing off flies, getting deeper and deeper until they either swim for a moment or turn back. I recognized it as a pattern of fear, that there was something shameful in it. These high-rises were not a country that existed in my youth or art or anywhere else. I had been a sheltered girl. Even when drug-addled, I would never have gone into a place like this. I tried to persuade myself onward. I counted the cracks in the pavement, cigarette butts, unopened letters with footprints on them, shards of broken glass. Someone whistled, but I didn't look his way. Some pot fumes drifted from an open window. For a moment, it wasn't like I was entering water at all. It was more like I was ferrying buckets of blood away from my own body, and I could feel them slap and spill as I moved. The dry brown remnants of a floral wreath hung outside the main doors. In the hallway, the mailboxes were dented and scorch-marked. There was a reek of roach spray. The overhead lights were spray-painted black for some reason. A large, middle-aged lady in a floral-patterned dress waited at the elevator. She kicked aside a used needle with a deep sigh. It settled into the corner, a small bubble of blood at its tip. I returned her nod and smile, her white teeth, the bounce of imitation pearls at her neck. "Nice weather," I said to her, though both of us knew exactly what sort of weather it was. The elevator rose, horses into rivers, watch me drown. I said goodbye to her on the fifth floor as she continued upward, the sound of the cables like the crack of old branches. A few people were gathered outside the doorway, black women mostly, in dark mourning clothes that looked as if they didn't belong to them, as if they'd hired the clothes for the day. Their makeup was the thing that betrayed them, loud and gaudy and one with silver sparkles around her eyes, which looked so tired and worn down. The cops had said something about hookers. It struck me that maybe the young girl had just been a prostitute. I felt a momentary sigh of gratitude, and then the awareness stopped me cold. The walls pulsed in on me. How cheap was I? What I was doing was unpardonable, and I knew it. I could feel my chest thumping in my blouse, but the women parted from me, and I went through their curtain of grief. The door was open. Inside, a young woman was sweeping the floor clean. She had a face that looked like it came from a Spanish mosaic. Her eyes were darkened with streaks of mascara, a simple silver chain around her neck. She was clearly no hooker. I felt immediately underdressed, like I was barging in on her silence. Beyond her, a replica of the man from the photo on the license, only heavier, jowlier, more sparsely stubbled. The sight of him knocked the oxygen out of me. He wore a white shirt and a dark tie and a jacket. His face was broad and slightly florid, his eyes puffy with grief. I stammered that I was from the hospital and that I was here to drop off the things that had belonged to a certain Mr. Corrigan. "Kieran Corrigan," he said, coming across and shaking my hand. He seemed to me first the sort of man who would be quite happy doing crosswords in bed. He took the box and looked down, searched through it. He came to the key ring and gazed at it a moment, put it in his pocket.
"Thanks," he said. "We forgot to pick these things up."
He had a touch of an accent to him, not very strong, but he carried his body like I had seen other Irishmen carry themselves, hunched into himself, yet still hyper-aware. The Spanish woman took the shirt and brought it into the kitchen. She was standing by the sink and sniffing the cloth deeply. The black bloodstains were still visible.
She looked across at me, lowered her gaze to the floor. Her small chest heaved. She suddenly ran the tap and plunged the cloth into the water and began wringing it, as if John A. Corrigan might suddenly appear and want to wear it again. It was quite obvious that I wasn't wanted or needed, but something held me there.
"We've got a funeral service in 45 minutes, he said, "if you'll excuse me."
A toilet flushed in the apartment above. "There was a young girl, too," I said.
"Yes, it's her funeral. Her mother's getting out of jail. That's what we heard. For an hour or two. My brother's service is tomorrow. Cremation. There have been some complications. Nothing to worry about."
"I see.
If you'll excuse me."
"Of course." A short, heavy-set priest made his way into the apartment, announcing himself as Father Marek. The Irishman shook his hand. He glanced at me as if to ask why I was still there. I went to the door, stopped, and turned around. It looked like the door locks had been jimmied a number of times. The Spanish woman was still in the kitchen, where she suspended the wet shirt from a hanger above the sink. She stood there with her head down, like she was trying to remember. She put her face in the shirt again. I turned and stammered. "Would you mind if I went to the girl's service?" He shrugged and looked at the priest, who scribbled a quick map on a scrap of paper, as if he was glad for something to do. He took me by the elbow and then down the corridor.
"Do you have any influence?" the priest asked.
"Influence?" I asked.
"Well, his brother has insisted on getting him cremated before he goes back to Ireland tomorrow, and I was wondering if you could talk him out of it."
"Why?"
"It's against our faith," he said.
Down the corridor, one of the women had begun wailing. She stopped, though, when the Irishman stepped out the door. He had jammed his tie high on his neck, and his jacket was pulled tight across his shoulders. He was followed by the Spanish woman, who had a stately pride about her. The corridor was hushed. He pressed the button for the elevator and looked at me. "Sorry," I said to the priest. "I don't have any influence." I pulled away from him and hurried toward the elevator as it was closing. The Irishman put his hand in the gap and pulled the door open for me, and then we were gone. The Spanish woman gave me a guarded smile and said she was sorry she couldn't go to the girl's funeral. She had to go home and look after her own children, but she was glad that Kieran had someone to go with. I offered him a lift without thinking, but he said no, that he had been asked to travel in the funeral cortege. He didn't know why. He wrung his hands nervously as he stepped out into the sunlight.
"I didn't even know the girl," he said.
"What was her name?"
"I don't know. Her mother's Tilly."
He said it with a downward finality, but then he added,
"I think it's Jaslyn or something."
I parked the car outside St. Raymond's Cemetery in Throgsneck, far enough away that nobody could see it. A hum came from the expressway, but the closer I got to the graveyard, the more the smell of fresh-cut grass filled the air, a faint whiff of the Long Island Sound. The trees were tall, and the light fell in shafts among them. It was hard to believe that this was the Bronx, although I saw the graffiti scrawled on the side of a few mausoleums, and some of the headstones near the gate had been vandalized. There were a few funerals in progress, mostly in the new cemetery, but it was easy enough to tell which group was the girls. They were carrying the coffin down the tree-lined road toward the old cemetery. The children were dressed in perfect white, but the women's clothes looked like they had been cobbled together, the skirts too short, the heels too high, their cleavage covered with wraparound scarves. It was like they had gone to a strange garage sale, the bright, expensive clothes hidden with bits and pieces of dark. The Irishman looked so pale among them, so very white. A man in a gaudy suit, wearing a hat with a purple feather, followed at the back of the procession. He looked drugged up and malevolent. Under his suit jacket, he wore a tight black turtleneck and a gold chain on his neck, a spoon hanging from it. A boy who was no more than 8 played a saxophone,
beautifully, like some strange drummer boy from the Civil War. The music rang out in punctuated bursts over the graveyard. I stayed in the background, near the road in a patch of overgrown grass, but as the service began, John A. Corrigan's brother caught my eye and beckoned me forward. There were no more than 20 people gathered around the graveside, but a few young women wailed deeply. "Kieran," he said again, extending his hand, as if I might have forgotten. He gave me a thin, embarrassed smile. We were the only white people there. I wanted to reach up and adjust his tie, fix his scattered hair, primp him. A woman, she could only have been the dead girl's mother, stood sobbing beside two men in suits. Another younger woman stepped up to her. She took off a beautiful black shawl and draped it on the mother's shoulders.
"Thanks, Ange."
The preacher, a thin, elegant black man, coughed, and the crowd fell silent. He talked about the spirit being triumphant in the body's fall, and how we must learn to recognize the absence of the body and praise the presence of what is left behind. Jaslyn had a hard life, he said. Death could not justify or explain it. A grave does not equal what we have had in our lifetime. It was maybe not the time or the place, he said, but he was going to talk about justice anyway. Justice, he repeated. Only candor and truth went out in the end. The house of justice had been vandalized, he said. Young girls like Jaslyn were forced to do horrific things. As they grew older, the world had demanded terrible things of them. This was a vile world. It forced her into vile things. She had not asked for it. It had become vile for her, he said. She was under the yoke of tyranny. Slavery may be over and gone, he said, but it was still apparent. The only way to fight it was with charity, justice, and goodness. It was not a simple plea, he said. Not at all. Goodness was more difficult than evil. Evil men knew that more than good men. That's why they became evil. That's why it stuck with them. Evil was for those who could never reach the truth. It was a mask for stupidity and lack of love. Even if people laughed at the notion of goodness, if they found it sentimental or nostalgic, it didn't matter. It was none of those things, he said. And it had to be fought for.
Justice, said Jaslyn's mother.
The preacher nodded, then looked up toward the high trees. Jaslyn had been a child who grew up in Cleveland and New York City, he said, and she had seen those distant hills of goodness, and she knew that one day she was going to get there. It was always going to be a difficult journey. She had seen too much evil on the way, he said. She had some friends and confidants, like John A. Corrigan, who had perished with her, but mostly the world had tried her and sentenced her and taken advantage of her kindness. But life must pass through difficulty in order to achieve any modicum of beauty, he said. And now she was on her way to a place where there were no governments to chain her or enslave her, no miscreants to demand the wrong thing, and none of her own people who were going to turn her flesh to profit. He stood tall then and said,
"Let it be said that she was not ashamed."
A wave of nods went around the crowd.
"Shame on those who wanted to shame her."
"Yes," came the reply.
"Let this be a lesson to us all," said the preacher. "You will be walking someday in the dark, and the truth will come shining through, and behind you will be a life that you never want to see again."
"Yes."
"That bad life, that vile life, in front of you will stretch goodness. You will follow the path, and it will be good. Not easy, but good. Full of terror and difficulty, maybe. But the windows will open to the sky, and your heart will be purified and you will take wing.
I had a sudden, terrible vision of Jaslyn flying through the windshield. I felt dizzy. The preacher's lips moved, but for a moment I couldn't hear. He was looking at a single place in the crowd, his vision fixed on the man in the purple hat behind me. I glanced over my shoulder. The man was biting his upper lip in anger, and his body seemed to curl into itself, coiling and getting ready to strike. The hat shadowed him, but he looked to have a glass eye.
"The snakes will perish with the snakes," said the preacher.
"Yes, sir,"
came a woman's voice.
"They'll be gone."
"Yes, they will."
"Be they out of here."
The man in the purple hat didn't move. Nobody moved.
"Go on,"
shouted Jaslyn's mother, contorting herself. She looked like she was strapped down, but she was wriggling and squirming out of it. One of the men in suits touched her arm. Her shoulders were going from side to side, and her voice was raw with rage.
"Get the fuck out of here!"
I wondered for a horrific moment if she was shouting at me, but she was staring beyond me, at the man in the feathered hat. The chorus of shouts rose higher. The preacher held his hands out and asked for calm. It was only then that I realized that Jaslyn's mother had kept her arms behind her back the whole time, shackled with handcuffs. The two black men in suits beside her were city cops.
"Get the fuck out, birdhouse," she said.
The man in the hat waited a moment, stretched upward, gave a smile that showed all his teeth. He touched the brim, tilted it, turned, and walked away. A small cheer went up from the mourners. They watched the pimp disappear down the road. He raised his hat one time without turning around, waved it in the air like a man who was not really saying goodbye.
"The snakes are gone," said the preacher. "Let them stay gone."
Kieran steadied my arm. I was feeling cold and dirty. It was like putting on a fourth-hand blouse. I had no right to be there. I was treading on their territory. But something in the service was pure and true. Behind you will be a life that you never want to see again. The wailing had stopped, and Jaslyn's mother said,
"Take these goddamn things off me."
Both cops stared straight ahead.
"I said, take these goddamn things off me!"
Finally, one of them stepped behind her and unlocked the handcuffs.
"Thank Jesus."
She shook her hands out and walked around the open grave, over toward Kieran. Her scarf fell slightly and revealed the depth of her cleavage. Kieran flushed red and embarrassed.
"I got a little story to tell," she said.
She cleared her throat, and a swell went around the crowd.
"My Jaslyn, she was 10, and she seed a picture of a castle in a magazine somewheres. She went, clipped it out, and taped it on the wall above her bed. Like I say, nothing much to it. I never really thought that much about it. But when she met Corrigan..."
She pointed over toward Kieran, who looked to the ground.
"And one day he was bringing around some coffee, and she told him all about it, the castle. Maybe she was bored, just wanted something to say, I don't know. But you know Corrigan, that cat would listen to just about anything. He had an ear. And of course, Corey got a kick out of that. He said he knew castles just like that where he growed up. And he said he'd bring her to a castle just like it one day, promised her solid. Every day he'd come out and bring her coffee, and he'd say to my little girl that he was getting that castle ready, just you wait. One day he'd tell her that he was getting the moat right. The next, he said he was working on the chains that go to the gate bridge. Then he said he was working on the turrets. Then he'd say he was getting the banquet all squared away. They were gonna have mead. That's like wine, and lots of good food, and there was going to be harps playing and lots of dancing.
Yes, said a woman in spangled makeup.
Every day he had a new thing to say about that castle. That was their own little game, and Jaslyn loved playing it word.
She grabbed hold of Kieran's arm.
That's all, she said. That's all I have to say. That's it. That's fucking it.